for Thoracic Surgical Perspective on Lung Cancer Management, I met with Dr. Frank Detterbeck, who began our conversation by presenting an interesting case from his practice.
68-year-old woman who just more or less had an incidental chest x-ray. I think she had a little bit of a cough, but had an incidental chest x-ray because there wasn't any pneumonia or anything that correlated with her cough. But she had bilateral upper lobe densities. Actually, she only had one density on a chest x-ray, but that led to a CT scan which showed bilateral upper lobe densities.
Smoking history?
She had smoked some in the past, but quit 25 years ago.
What was her overall condition and performance status?
She was in good shape. She lived with her husband, wasn't working, but was out and about shopping and excellent performance status.
What was the workup that you recommended or instituted for this woman?
Well, so she presented with a CT scan, and she had bilateral lesions. So in the right upper lobe, she had a lesion that had a solid component. It was about a centimeter and a half in size, but most of it was ground glass. So I would say that about 20% was solid and the rest of it was ground glass. And in the left upper lobe, she had another lesion that was about the same size. It was a little bit smaller, I think maybe about 1.2 centimeters, and that was really all ground glass.
So when you looked at this with your radiologist, were you making some guesses about what the histology might be?
Yeah. So for one, we see people with small ground glass opacities pretty commonly if you just do routine CT scans. And I think that's an issue that we have to address sort of in the modern world, you know, because we didn't used to see it or didn't used to appreciate it, but we see it pretty commonly. And the guidelines that we follow are that if those are less than 5 millimeters, we really don't worry about them much at all. We do get a follow-up scan in a year. If they're between 5 and 10 millimeters, we worry a little bit more, but if it's a pure ground glass area, the vast majority of those are going to turn out to be AAH, which is benign, you know, atypical adenomatous hyperplasia. And so if it's less than a centimeter and doesn't have a solid component, we generally watch it. Now, once it's over a centimeter, you end up having about a 20% chance that this is going to be a bronchoalveolar carcinoma, maybe with a small focus of invasive adenocarcinoma, and we worry about those more. I think especially when the ground glass area develops a solid component, you have a very high chance that that's going to be an invasive adenocarcinoma with peripheral BAC features.
So what was the next step?
Our suspicion was pretty high that that's what she had, that she had an adenocarcinoma on the right side and a BAC on the left side, possibly an invasive cancer there too. And so the next step for us was that we wanted to assess her pulmonary function status and get some idea of what she would tolerate.
And what did you find there?
Well, she actually had excellent pulmonary function tests. So her FEV1, if I remember right, was around 85% or so, but it was very good. And her diffusion capacity was also good, which was consistent with her excellent performance status. So not a big surprise.
What happened next?
Well, we work as a team. So we discuss things in a multidisciplinary team. And we feel pretty comfortable when we all put our heads together that we can make a good plan. And we were pretty comfortable that both of these were high likelihood of being adenocarcinoma and BAC, and that a needle biopsy, for example, wasn't going to really dissuade us from pursuing that. So we discussed it as a group. That includes radiologists, pulmonologists, medical oncologists, radiation oncologists, a couple of thoracic surgeons. And our consensus was that we thought the chance of this being an adenocarcinoma with a focal solid component in the right upper lobe was probably around 85%. And on the other side, I think we were a little less sure that this would turn out to be BAC, but greater than 50% at least sure of that. And so we started talking about resection of those. Now, I can go on a little bit. We see a lot more patients with what I call multifocal disease. They have more than one area. And I think that that is a different phenomenon than metastasis. Typically, when you see someone with another nodule in the lung, you think, oh, they've got stage 4 disease. This is a metastasis. But these people that present with these multifocal areas that have a ground glass component, they almost never have any distant metastases or any nodal involvement. And so where we used to be more aggressive about doing PET scans and doing mediastinoscopy, we don't anymore when this is a predominant ground glass component.
It's interesting talking about multifocal disease because, I don't know, just sort of reflexly, I don't think about the other contralateral organ, you know, like breast cancer, multifocal, you're usually thinking about within one breast.
Right.
So you're saying multifocal within the two lungs.
Yes, that's right.
I mean, it makes sense, but it's just kind of like not what we normally think of. So have you actually seen cases like that?
Oh, yeah. I see them all the time.
Really?
I mean, this woman is an example. And as I mentioned earlier, I just saw the scans this morning of someone who has a very similar presentation.
Now, this multifocal phenomenon, is it mainly with adeno and BAC?
Yes. Yes.
So what was the next step with this woman?
Well, so she had excellent pulmonary function tests. As I say, for peripheral lesions that are relatively small and primarily ground glass, if the mediastinum is negative on CT scan, I don't think that there's really value in doing a mediastinoscopy. And I think the chance of picking up some distant metastasis by PET scan is very low. And for that matter, the value of a PET scan to add diagnostic information about the lesions is also pretty low if it's ground glass because it invariably doesn't light up. So what we talked to her about is that we thought both of these lesions were likely to be cancer and that we should probably remove both of them, that they were likely to be two synchronous early stage cancers. The other thing about it, though, is that, you know, many of these ground glass lesions seem to be more indolent tumors. And I think that's an important point. We have thought of lung cancer in kind of a black and white fashion. It's either cancer or it's benign. And if it's cancer, it's going to kill you. It's bad. It's all the same. And it's really not. There's a spectrum of disease. And in the past, we didn't see those indolent, slow-growing tumors as much, but we certainly see them more now. And I think they raise a lot of questions about how do you approach that? How aggressive should you be? We talked about a thoracoscopic approach, a bilateral thoracoscopic approach, but we ended up electing to do a sternotomy. And that was just because of where the lesion on the right side was located. It would have been somewhat difficult to approach it thoracoscopically and easier to do through an open approach. And, you know, a sternotomy, it certainly sounds worse, but I think that the recovery time and the amount of pain is probably not that much different from bilateral thoracoscopy. So we did a sternotomy, and we did a segmentectomy on the left side. It was an apical segment. We did a segmentectomy on the left side, and on the right side just did a wedge resection of the right upper lobe.
And what was seen?
Well, they both actually turned out to be invasive adenocarcinoma. The one on the left side that was essentially all ground glass had just a very small focus of invasive adenocarcinoma, about 10%. And the one on the right side had the solid component was clearly an invasive adenocarcinoma.
You mentioned an issue of sublobectomy. Can you comment on the ACOS trial looking at that?
Well, there are two trials. So the American College of Surgeons is doing a trial that's really geared a little bit more towards people that are having a sublobar resection as a compromised procedure with brachytherapy, with a mesh that has radioactive seeds sewn in it. And that's an ongoing trial, and we really don't know the answer to that, obviously. There's some preliminary data that suggests that may be worthwhile, but that's preliminary data. I don't think we know the answer. The CLGB is also running a trial of lesions that are less than 2 centimeters that are randomized to either a lobectomy or a sublobar resection.
Are you participating in that study?
We are participating in the CLGB study, but not in the ACOSOC study.
What do you think those two studies are going to show? Any guesses?
So my guess is actually that for the CLGB study that we are going to find that lobectomy is still better. I think the CLGB study casts the net a little bit too broadly because I think 2-centimeter solid tumor, you know, I think that's a little bit different than a 1.2-centimeter ground glass lesion. And because they've made the net fairly broad, I think that it's going to show that lobectomy is still better, although I think that there are tumors that may well be well treated with a sublobar resection.
What about the issue of the mediastinum during surgery? Did you do a mediastinoscopy or you just let it go?
Well, we didn't do a mediastinoscopy, but we always do a systematic sampling of mediastinal nodes at least. Usually I do a mediastinal node dissection. In this case, with the sternotomy, it was more practical to just do a systematic sampling. So a systematic sampling is you try to get a node from each node station, left and right paratracheal and subcarinal biopsy representative nodes. I do think that that is standard of care for lung cancer surgery. Unfortunately, it's not necessarily what's practiced as broadly as we would like.
What is being done?
Well, I think there are a lot of surgeons that grew up with a more nihilistic attitude about lung cancer and really haven't focused that well on paying attention to a lot of details. And so I think they do a lobectomy and then just kind of say, well, the patient's lucky, they'll do okay. And if they're unlucky, it isn't going to matter anyway because there's nothing else to do. And that's really not true. I mean, there are a lot of other therapies nowadays for lung cancer. Perhaps it wasn't true 30 years ago, but it is now.
Where do you think patients with lung cancer in general are being operated on and by whom? Are the majority being operated on by thoracic surgeons in a community hospital, or what's your take on that? And what do you think about the quality, not just of the surgery technically, but also the kind of decision-making by surgeons related to this?
Well, you're getting me off into an area that I think is crucially important, actually. I think that there is a huge disparity in quality across the country. There was a recent study that was just done looking at the SEER Medicare data and looking at what kind of staging tests people had. And patients that had only one staging test, that is a CT scan, had statistically significantly worse survival than patients that had a CT and a PET, or a CT and a PET and mediastinoscopy, or endobronchial ultrasound with biopsy or something like that. The thing that was dramatic about this, though, is that the increase in survival was 3 or 4 times what we get from other things that we get all excited about. So, for example, adjuvant chemotherapy. We're all excited about that we have that for early stage lung cancer. And yet, just doing better staging gives you 3 or 4 times as much benefit as adjuvant chemotherapy. And so, if we're really serious about doing a better job for patients, we've got to start getting our hands around this quality issue.
And do you think that the majority of the surgery is actually being performed by thoracic surgeons who maybe are doing cardiac surgery and a lot of other things?
Yes, I think so. I think that the minority is being done by dedicated thoracic surgeons that really have a focused interest. And we know that 30 or 40% is being done by general surgeons that do a lot of other things. And, you know, about 30% or so is being done by cardiothoracic surgeons that really are very focused on cardiac surgery and don't really focus as much on thoracic.
What about the prognosis of this woman? And when you think about it, what kind of tumor size do you consider that she has? I mean, this comes up in breast cancer all the time where they say they have 2 simultaneous primaries and they look at the risk of relapse. They don't add them. They're like separate. It's kind of weird. Is that what's done in lung? I mean, to me, it's kind of strange.
Well, we've kind of changed our thinking a little bit. So patients that have synchronous primaries of run-of-the-mill lung cancer. So they've got a solid spiculated lung cancer and one on each side or in different lobes. Clearly, the survival data is not all that good. On average, you're talking a 5-year survival of maybe 30% or so. even if they are both stage ones, still 30%. So not very good. Now, that's on average. If you actually look at the studies, they're all over the map. They're anywhere from 0 to 70%, which makes me think that we're not all that good at really figuring out who has synchronous primaries and who has metastatic disease. So for those patients, we think that they have a worse prognosis. We're very, very careful to rule out distant metastases. We always do a PET scan. We always do a brain MRI. We always do a mediastinoscopy ahead of time. And we're pretty careful, and we do approach them as synchronous primaries if we can't find anything else, but we're much more worried that, in fact, we may have jumped to that conclusion, and it's really metastatic disease from the get-go, and within a short period of time, they're going to have a lot of disease showing up.
Now, did this woman receive adjuvant therapy?
Well, she did not. So although we're very worried about these patients with synchronous primaries, people that present with this multifocal disease with primarily ground glass tumors, I think that's a different story. And I don't think that we understand it that well. So I wish we did, but I think it's a different story. And so I think there's good data that you can approach them with a sublobar resection. I think there's good data that their chance of showing up with distant mets or mediastinal disease is pretty low. And we really don't treat them with adjuvant therapy. Now, if she had had an EGFR mutation, we probably would have treated her with that, although we debate that and we struggle with that issue. As it turns out, she did not have a mutation. And when we have discussed whether she should get some adjuvant chemotherapy of some sort other than an EGFR inhibitor, it doesn't really make sense to us because I think that her risk is primarily of developing a new focus of cancer. And I don't think that we've got good data that chemotherapy as a chemopreventative agent really is worthwhile.
You mentioned endobronchial ultrasound. Any comments about how that procedure is being utilized right now and what your thoughts are about it? I know you've written about this.
So I think it's, you know, certainly an advance in technology. I think it's exciting. I think that it's very important to stage people accurately, as I mentioned, and it may well help us in that regard. The results look pretty promising. I do worry a little bit, though, about how well those results are going to actually translate as we roll it out more broadly. Right now, we've got papers from people that have developed this technology, clearly are experts, and are we going to be able to duplicate those results broadly? Probably not. So I think it has a place and has a role, although exactly how far we go with that role, I think we're going to have to let that play itself out over the next several years and see how good the results really are.
What about the issue of pre-op systemic therapy? There are trials that are looking at this, and also trials even looking at new agents in the preoperative setting to try to find tissue markers that correlate with response. But what about in the non-protocol setting? In what situations do you think about working with your oncologist to shrink the tumor down?
Yeah, so I have a very balanced view about that. I think that people should be treated with more aggressive therapy on a protocol, ideally. And I have no problem supporting an aggressive protocol with neoadjuvant or preoperative therapy and then surgery. And I also have no problem supporting a protocol with aggressive therapy without surgery. And in fact, that's exactly the history of what we've done. I flip-flopped back and forth. So for a while, we were supporting the RTOG protocol that had a fairly aggressive induction regimen followed by surgery. Put people on that. We closed that protocol. We opened a protocol with very aggressive chemo-rads without surgery. And I think more aggressive treatment has some appeal to me if we're going to try to push the envelope. But I think that you can make arguments to do that with or without surgery, and we really don't know the answer.
Are there any other issues that we haven't talked about today that you think would be useful to get into?
Well, I think that we can talk a little bit more about stage 3 disease. So one of the things that a lot of people do is they say, well, let's give some preoperative therapy, and then we'll see how much it shrinks. And if it looks good, maybe we'll consider surgery. And if it doesn't look so good, maybe we won't. Well, I think just looking at a CT scan or a PET scan, although it gives you some indication perhaps of what's going on, it really doesn't correlate that well with what's going on a cellular level. And we really don't have good data that that's a way to select patients. Now, other people would say, well, we're not going to just look at what it looks like radiographically. We're going to restage the patient by doing mediastinal node biopsies. And if patients have persistent N2 disease in the mediastinum, they're not going to get an operation. If they're downstaged in the mediastinum, we'll do an operation. And I must say I have some trouble with that approach as well. Clearly, there is data that responders do better. So those people that are downstaged, they're going to do better. But I don't really know which way to make that argument. So does that mean that because the chemo and radiation worked so well and they were downstaged that they should have surgery? Or does it mean that they don't really need to have surgery because it's probably going to be very effective in the primary tumor as well, and they probably don't need surgery? And vice versa, for those patients who have persistent N2 disease in the mediastinum, although their survival is worse, it's about 15% with surgery. And I don't really know, you know, if they weren't downstaged, should they get an operation because the chemo and radiation really didn't work all that well to downstage them? Maybe they should. Maybe they're the ones we should be operating on. So I think that although that sort of crept into people's thinking, I don't see the data that really supports that on a strict scientific level as a way of selecting patients.
You were talking about the difference in outcomes based on whether surgery is done by a thoracic surgical oncologist or a community thoracic surgeon. What do you think the solution to this problem is?
Well, I think that, you know, for one, we are becoming more sophisticated about lung cancer. For a while, I think lung cancer was just, you know, everybody was nihilistic about it. And I think that in general, pulmonologists and many people are becoming a little bit more sophisticated, and they can recognize good staging and bad staging and becoming more sophisticated. I also think that we probably need to organize our care delivery a little bit better. I think that results in general are worse for a general surgeon, but I don't think it's because a general surgeon's a bad surgeon. I think it's just if they're trying to keep tabs on colon cancer and pancreatic cancer and breast cancer and lung cancer, well, they're just not going to be able to do as good a job. And so I think that if we develop more collaborative systems where people that have a more focused interest can say, well, this is sort of how this should be approached at this stage of disease, and we'll work with you and we'll help you, and things that you're perfectly capable of doing, that's fine. And things that are perhaps getting to be a little bit more complicated, you know, you need to recognize that and we'll help you with that. So I think that all that's coming, and I think that the American College of Surgeons is certainly putting in quality criteria and focusing on that. There's pay for performance, all of this. I think that this is all coming. It's just that healthcare in this country needs a lot of work, and it's going to take a while, I think, before we really get organized the way that we should.